If our cholesterol, including LDL, is too low, that has the most detrimental effect on our health, as well as our fertility.
This is the True Health Report, where critical appraisal fuels true freedom.
Hello, everyone, and welcome. I have a very important topic to discuss today, and which is fertility. And also there will be a bonus hypothesis about sexually transmitted diseases for those of you who may still be wondering about that in the context of terrain theory. So if we look at some of the international organizations, major news outlets, sources like the United Nations and Bill Gates, they would have us believe that we are facing a population crisis that has consequences against humanity. Of course, this is within various false narratives, such as public health or global health, as well as climate change. But if we look at actual data, we get a very, very different story. So that's where I'm going to begin today. So let me bring up my slides. All right. So I'm going to talk about this from the perspective of men and women here. So you're going to see some things that might be gender specific, but this is generally speaking about fertility across the board. So what we can look at here, though, is hormone levels of sex hormones. We have heard a lot about this crisis of, you know, low T among the male middle age and aging population especially, but we can see this really in all age ranges. And what we have here are graphs that show the level of total testosterone, and on the x-axis we have people's age. And there are three different data sets. The top line is the levels from 1987 to 89, the middle line from 95 to 97, and the bottom line from 02 to 04. And we can see if we look at each successive line in time that the starting testosterone levels were lower. And we can do this, you know, based on the exact age match if you look up vertically from the x-axis. And we can also see that over the lifespan from mid-40s up until the 80s, that we have declines in total testosterone level, but also the shape of this curve has changed from the 80s and 90s to the 2000s, where now, rather than testosterone leveling off at around age originally 60 and then 70 in the subsequent data set, now instead of leveling off or slightly rising at that point, it continues to go down and at a precipitous rate. So something has occurred that has brought about this change in testosterone in men, which has become a major health issue. Now, we can also look at the male perspective in terms of sperm count. Now, sperm count is not the only variable to look at that tells you about sperm's ability to conceive and engage in fertility behaviors, because there's also the shape or morphology of the sperm, the motility or movement of the sperm, and other variables. But if we just look at the count, we can see here, now this data was regressed into a line so that you can see the average change over the time period in a linear fashion, but it didn't occur exactly that way. But we can see that when we compare the data from 50 years ago, 1973, there was an average of 101 million sperm per milliliter of seminal fluid. And now in 2018, the more recent data, there is just under half of that number on average. Now, this paper actually updates a previous paper that was missing some continents, specifically Africa and I believe Australia, but don't quote me on that. But this data set includes really the entire Earth. And if we look at the blue and red line at the bottom left panel, we have basically the change from 1972 to the present. And then another data set that just looks at the past 20 years. So the blue line looks at 50 years to up to 2018. And the red line just looks at the past 18 years. And you can see that the rate of decline is accelerating over time, just like we saw with the decline in testosterone levels in the previous data set. Now, if we look at fertility, which is defined in this paper as the number of offspring that a woman has during her reproductive years in her lifetime, going back to 1963 up through 2020, we can see that back in the 60s, that women had around 5+ children on average over their reproductive years. But now it is down under 2.5. Okay. And this is also global data. Okay, so worldwide data, if we looked just in Western countries, we'd see lower numbers. One interesting thing on this, back to this study for a second, is that they also looked at the relationship between the world gross domestic product and total fertility rate and found an inverse relationship. So as countries got wealthier, their fertility rates declined. And this is commonly thought of to be explained as people have more resources, they decide to have less children. But I don't think that really explains this finding. Now, if we look just in the United States, and this is still several years ago, back to 2017, that we see that the birth rates or fertility rates was already below replacement levels and by a significant margin of 16%. And I believe that the numbers have only gotten more drastic. And what this means is that if we continue at this current birth rate, that our population is going to decline precipitously. And there is a theoretical point of a decline of a population where it basically they become extinct, or it's very, very difficult to reestablish a significant population. So this is quite serious and obviously completely the opposite of what we're told about overpopulation being problems. So let's now talk about what could be the cause of this issue. And we're going to start off talking about endocrine disrupting chemicals, because these have been shown to interfere with reproduction in a variety of different types of scientific experiments. And we'll give this definition from Kavlock, which states an exogenous agent, that means it comes from outside the body, that interferes with a variety of different aspects, right? The synthesis, secretion, transport, binding, action is kind of generic, or elimination of natural hormones in the body responsible for the regulation of homeostasis, which is like equilibrium, and the regulation of developmental processes, right? Like reproduction, okay. And of course, endocrine refers to the hormones, right, which includes the sex hormones of testosterone, estrogen, and progesterone. So if we look at what a category of endocrine disruptors called xenoestrogens or foreign estrogenic substances, these are some proposed mechanisms that they may interfere with our body's own response to estrogen. So they may mimic estrogens, have a similar chemical structure that interacts with our body, fooling our body into thinking that we are making more estrogen. It could antagonize estrogens, so act to counteract estrogens, right? And this may be important for women's fertility, for example, altering the synthesis of estrogens, either by inhibiting or upregulating, and modifying estrogen receptor expression. So however our cells receive the estrogen signal from the hormone itself could be disrupted by that mechanism. Now, here are some common compounds that could be xenoestrogens or disrupt other endocrine systems. And these include a variety of compounds of the class of pesticides and herbicides, which may be in our food supply or in environmental exposure in buildings or agricultural land, etc. And these have been shown to have specific effects on sperm, for example, as well as on the estrogen and testosterone system. Organophosphates, atrazine. Atrazine is one that you may have heard of. Alex Jones at the famous meme of gay frogs related to atrazine, where a scientist from Berkeley studied them on amphibians and found that they had ambiguous and hermaphroditic genitalia when exposed to atrazine.
I don't like them putting chemicals in the water that turn the friggin' frogs gay. Serious crap.
And atrazine is unregulated to this day. It was proposed for regulation by the EPA, but they refused to regulate it. So you can get exposure to this from the environment. Then we have plasticizing chemicals like phthalates and BPA that I'm going to talk more specifically about, as well as heavy metals like cadmium, lead, and mercury, which we could be exposed to from a variety of sources, including, for example, drinking water, pharmaceuticals, etc. Now, I also want to clarify that, and I've taught this before, obviously, especially with the power of pine, that we have two broad categories of toxic substances that come into our body. We have water-soluble and fat-soluble substances. And that's important because our body processes these types of foreign toxins in a different way. The water-soluble ones, our body can readily eliminate. And if we eliminate or reduce our exposure to those things, our body can completely get rid of them within even hours, sometimes depending on the substance, or within days. Fat-soluble toxins, on the other hand, is much more difficult for our body to deal with, and they often become stored in fatty tissue in our body. And in order to get them out, it requires a bit more work. So on this table, you'll see that some of these substances are water-soluble and some are fat-soluble. So if we look specifically at human semen, and this was known all the way back in the early 80s, that we've found a lot of these toxic substances in men's semen. So in this study, they found heavy metals and organochlorine compounds, which are a class of pesticides, in the semen samples. And there were actually significant correlations between some of the heavy metals as well as some of these other substances, like even DDT, which was taken off the market decades before this study, was still found in human semen. Now, if we look at a more recent study here, the LIFE study, which looked specifically at these persistent organic pollutants, and these are substances like DDT, for example, like the PFAS or PFOAS forever chemicals, which persist in the environment for a very long time because there's no natural mechanism to break them down into recyclable units. So here we had looked for quite a number of different substances in semen in this study, and it was found that the concentration or levels of these substances showed a lot of associations with the quality of the semen. And PDBEs, polybrominated diphenyl ethers, which are a class of flame retardant chemicals, were particularly associated with abnormal sperm morphology or shape. So we're starting to see some direct evidence that these things are in the semen and that they are correlated mathematically with disruptions in the semen quality. Now, this is another interesting study, and this research looking for microplastics in biological tissue is somewhat controversial because there's a criticism that there, in certain settings, especially in hospitals, that there is such a large concentration of microplastic particles that they could have contaminated the specimen rather than the particles pre-existing in the specimen. But I would give some common sense counterpoint to that argument, which is that if there are so many microplastics in the environment, you can't do a study without contamination. It would stand to reason that being in that environment would cause those particles to be taken up by your body through your body being contaminated in the same way. Now, the microplastic particles themselves may not be directly toxic, although they may cause mechanical obstruction or disruption of function, depending on their size. But they have been shown in a variety of research to absorb lots of other substances, which could include very toxic substances like pesticides and heavy metals. So it could be that these microplastics, if they are actually in our tissues, could be sequestering some of these toxic compounds, which can exert toxic effects on our tissues if they're there for a significant period of time. Now, here's a further analysis using a different analytical method, which found plastic additives and forever chemicals, the same flame retardants that were found in the life study, surfactants, which are used in a lot of cleaning products, as well as laundry detergent, and insecticides. And they said specifically the plastic additives were identified and they felt that indicated potential health risks. Okay, so once again, we find evidence of the same chemicals in semen. And also, if we look at the female anatomy, we see the same thing. So here we have a study that looked at follicular fluid, and this is the fluid in the ovaries that surrounds the mother's eggs that are being stored for future menstrual cycles, and that there were lead and cadmium found in this fluid, so heavy metals. And then we see this other study looking at PFOAS, finding those forever chemicals in follicular fluid. And also, interestingly, referencing this other study by Dingra, which I've also looked at, where they find PFAS in menstrual fluid. And this fits with a long-standing hypothesis that I've had, which is that women, when they menstruate, their body takes advantage of that reproductive function to dump toxins because the body is getting rid of some fluid and tissue. So the toxins end up being delivered to the uterus to leave the body in the menstrual fluid. And this has been actually demonstrated by analyzing for those chemicals in the menstrual secretions. So we see evidence for both men and women that we are excreting a variety of toxic chemicals in our sexual fluids. That's the fluid that's bathing the eggs and the sperm. And this is an obvious hypothesis for this fertility reduction because these compounds were introduced into the environment at the same time that the fertility crisis has been occurring. And unfortunately, the mainstream medical establishment is not really looking at this very much at all. They instead prefer to look at it from the perspective of lifestyle factors, things like exercise, smoking, alcohol, etc. But those things were actually more prominent in the past when the fertility rate was higher. So we can see that that does not explain it, just like genetics does not explain it, because even if the theory of genetic determination were valid, there is no sense that vast mutations affecting fertility could occur in this very short time frame of about 50 years. So what we're really left with is, one is the effect of these toxic substances that are clearly in our sexual and reproductive fluids and organs. Now, this also provides an obvious hypothesis for sexually transmitted diseases, because if our sexual secretions that occur, you know, during intercourse or other sexual activities are full of toxic chemicals, and we are essentially exposing someone else's body to these, and specifically their genital area, it would make sense that it could be toxic to the tissue. It could be toxic to the vaginal mucosa, the labia, the glans, penis, right? So, for example, if we see the chancre of syphilis, right, which is an ulcerated lesion in the tip of the penis or in the external genitalia of the woman, well, isn't it a highly likely possibility that there were toxic substances that were exposed to that area? And also during intercourse, we have microtrauma, which is increased due to circumcision. Actually, the friction is increased. And so there are small micro abrasions of the sexual tissue that allow for these toxins to become absorbed essentially into the skin. And then the skin wants to purge them, so it would develop a lesion. And I think this is, you know, a highly likely hypothesis to explain this observation that sometimes we have this alleged sexually transmitted disease. Now, I just wanted to highlight before we get into the other side of the coin that some of these compounds, these endocrine disruptors that may be affecting fertility, if we stop exposing ourselves to them, that we can get rid of them pretty quickly. So if we look at PBDEs, right, which are the flame retardants I mentioned that have been shown to have an adverse effect on semen quality and probably have a similar adverse effect on the quality of eggs, that simply by sweating, we can get rid of these substances, right? Because they are water soluble. And the same thing is true with bisphenols and phthalates. So I would say that any detoxifying regimen where you're trying to get rid of endocrine disrupting and xenoestrogen compounds should include some form of sweating, which could be from saunas, could be from intense exercise, or even just putting layers of clothes on yourself to overheat yourself and make you sweat. And this can be done on even up to a daily basis, but it won't take very long to eliminate most of those substances from your body as long as you become aware of how they're getting in your body in the first place and you eliminate those sources. This can be from the flame retardants. They are used often in textiles to make them flame retardant. And so check all the textiles, including the furniture that you're exposed to, clothing, pajamas, etc., to see if you're getting exposed that way. Like, for example, I sometimes have been known to race cars on the track. And if I wear a race suit, race suits are specifically flame retardant suits. So I try to wear an inner layer, even though this is not recommended, of cotton on my skin to prevent those chemicals from being absorbed from the suit. So you can identify those exposures and reduce or eliminate those completely. So clothing obviously is a big one, as well as food containers and packaging, especially if you're going to microwave food in plastics, it will leach these chemicals into the food. So now let's talk about some dietary factors, because this is the other edge of the coin. Now, I can't say that seed oil toxicity directly contributes to fertility, but I wanted to point this out because of obesity, and obesity may correlate with some of these other problems. And also because essentially what's happened here is that healthy fats have been replaced with these seed oils, and a deficiency in healthy fats is a big part of this fertility issue. So this is the consumption of seed oils, where you could see at the turn of the 20th century, they were practically non-existent because they were used as machine lubricants. And now over the course of the century, for a variety of economic and other reasons, now we have a huge use of them. And here it breaks them down by specific type of oil. And this is a curve from the CDC looking at obesity over the course of the 1960s, projected through 2030. And I thought it was really fascinating that if you take these two curves and superimpose them, that you see that they mirror each other quite well. Now, I adjusted the timescale there to match up, and you can see that there is a slight lag between when the consumption of the seed oils increases and when the obesity is occurring. So that suggests, but does not prove, a causal relationship that could be looked into further. Now, this is just for your informational purposes, because the linoleic acid is the main constituent of the seed oils that becomes stored in our fatty tissue, often in the same fraction as the so-called membrane lipids. And they can have a half-life, I believe, of up to 2 years. So these things really persist in your body. They can't be adequately metabolized as fat, so they get stored. And it's the linoleic acid that's the major constituent. So you could see that these oils in red at the top have the highest levels of linoleic acid. And in the middle, gold and yellow are intermediate levels. So we see olive oil there, avocado oil, palm oil, and lard, which is pork fat. And those are acceptable to eat in general. And then the green, the best ones at the bottom, and the numbers there reflect what's actually in our bodies. So we have very small amounts of linoleic acid in our own body fat, right, on the order of 1-2%. And if you look at grass-fed beef tallow, right there at 1%. And so coconut oil, in terms of any vegetable or plant sources of fat would be the best one to use in cooking. And that's really the only one that I recommend. Now, you can buy, for example, mayonnaise prepared with olive oil or avocado oil, and those are not too bad. But you can make your own mayonnaise at home using beef tallow, for example. Okay, so let's get into the cholesterol issue, because this more directly speaks to fertility, because our sex hormones are made from cholesterol as the starting material. So if our body does not have adequate stores of cholesterol and saturated fats, we cannot synthesize adequate sex hormones or vitamin D for that matter, or new cells for that matter. And new cells are more directly required for survival. So if our body has a limited supply of the right fats and cholesterol, it may use them for cellular growth instead of to support our sexual hormones and fertility. So this is quite an issue. Now, this is from Johns Hopkins, but it agrees with all the other medical authorities. They say the normal levels or optimal levels of cholesterol are, and they want it, your total cholesterol to be less than 200, and they want your LDL to be less than 100. And the assumption here is that those numbers would improve your health and longevity. But if we look here at this graph, and this graph, it's from a British heart study source. It's listed on the bottom, but it combines a lot of data worldwide, but I'll show you a more limited data set that has the same exact finding. And this is what's known as a reverse J curve. And on the y-axis is the total cholesterol. And on the y-axis is all-cause mortality for the blue line, which is what we're going to look at, the dark blue line. And the x-axis is the total cholesterol level. And this is known as an inverted J curve. And what we see here is that at the nadir of the curve, the lowest point is where we have the lowest mortality or the highest survival. And then as the curve goes up in both directions from that nadir point, we have increased mortality. Now, what is the nadir point? It is just over 220 for total cholesterol. So in other words, best survival and lowest mortality occurs at a total cholesterol of just over 220. Now, what were the recommendations? That it should be below 200. So if we go over to the 200 point on the graph, we see that the all-cause mortality is now significantly elevated. And if we go lower than 200, there is a steep slope where the mortality increases. So each number lower means that we are more likely to die. Okay. Now, this also, although it's not reported here, has consequences for fertility and other types of sexual and reproductive functioning. Now, here is a data set just looking at adults in Korea, but it's a large number of adults, almost 13 million. And we see essentially the same reverse J curve here. And on the bottom right panel, it looks at men and women separately. But we see here that actually the lowest mortality is just over 220. And that when we get below 200, we see the increasing hazard ratio is reported here, but that's the hazard of all-cause mortality. And when we look separately in men and women, we see that the increase in mortality is slightly steeper for men. Now, I also want to mention a data set looking at LDL cholesterol, which was also mentioned. And there it was said that optimally below 100. But this study says, in conclusion, we found that low level of LDL is associated with a higher risk of all-cause mortality. And this observed association persisted after adjusting for potential confounders. So the same finding, they represented it differently here. This is a forest plot. And you could see that this vertical line at one represents no change in all-cause mortality. Anything to the right of it is more deaths, and to the left of it is less. Now you could see that as the LDL goes up from 100 to 129 and going down on this graph, that really there's no change in mortality. If anything, it's slightly lower in the 130 to 160 range, but that interval still crosses the one line. So I would say it's no change. But if we look at the low LDL, 70 to 99, it's clearly off the reference line. So we have increased mortality. And if it's below 70, then we're approaching two times the mortality. So once again, what the data shows is that if our cholesterol, including LDL, is too low, that has the most detrimental effect on our health as well as our fertility. So in my opinion, the two most likely culprits that have caused this fertility crisis where we are now below replacement levels for certain in the Western countries and possibly globally, that we have one, the exposure to a variety of toxins, especially persistent toxins with endocrine disrupting and xenoestrogenic properties that often can be stored in our body's tissues for a long time, but clearly are shown to be present in significant amounts in semen as well as follicular and menstrual fluid. And then in addition to that, we have a crisis of a deficiency of cholesterol, a nutritional deficiency of saturated fats and cholesterol that don't allow our bodies to make the things it needs, including the sex hormones, and increase our all-cause mortality substantially. So we can see that you have the education of how to overcome this because you can address the toxins by simply reducing your exposure and sweating and doing some form of lipolytic protocol where you can melt away the body fat and get rid of those fat-soluble toxins like the Power of Pine protocol. And you can start eating a higher fat, higher cholesterol diet using the right types of fats for cooking and focusing on increasing those levels to optimal ranges in your body. Even if you're doing your best to live clean, you're still being exposed. From off-gassing furniture and plastics in your food to synthetic fibers, personal care products, and even medical imaging procedures, especially fat-soluble chemicals, these toxins don't respond to your average detox. They settle deep in your tissues, and you need the right tools to clear them out. That's why I created the Ultimate Detox Protocol, a free 30-day roadmap that teaches you a serious nature-based detox using pine, targeted nutrition, and a focused daily plan. You'll choose the cleansing diet that fits your needs, support your elimination pathways, and take action against the toxin load that's been holding you back. Many people who've done this protocol have reported major improvements in energy, focus, digestion, and even long-standing symptoms they thought they'd have to live with forever. Unfortunately, I can't share the full scope of results people have experienced using this protocol, not on this platform. If I did, the video would surely be taken down. But trust me, it is incredibly powerful. Download it for free at the link in the show notes. Your health is your responsibility, and this is the best place to start. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you in the next True Health Report.